case, which is Wisconsin versus Day. Mr. Merkel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Neil Merkel. I represent Day. Day removed this case along with 15 others in October of 2006. Ultimately, those cases were remanded. Of the 16 cases, only one court granted attorney's fees under 1447C, and that was the District of Wisconsin, which we've appealed from. Our contention is that it is manifestly an error. It doesn't really follow Martin or this court's decision in Lott.
Well, I understand your argument that, you know, your removal wasn't so crazy that you ought to have to pay a sanction. I understand that. But what about the underlying issue, whether it's permissible to remove these cases?
I was hoping we could get to that. Let me start, Your Honor, then, with the first, the implicated statutes. Title 31, 37, 32B. That's the statute in the False Claims Act. It says the district court shall have jurisdiction over any action brought under the laws of any state. Everyone agrees here that this case fits that definition. It is a state court action brought to enforce state law, and it arises out of the same facts and circumstances as the False Claims Act that the United States unsealed. So there's no question that it applies to the case. The statute we submit is clear on its face. It says,
because look, isn't this just a supplemental jurisdiction statute?
Well, I guess certainly it performs that function.
And this supplemental jurisdiction statute is worded just like this, 1367, but it's always been understood to mean, yeah, you join parties and claims in the same case. You don't bring the claim in another district.
Well, the thing is, though, this, Your Honor, though, this statute would have permitted Wisconsin not only to file and intervene in the District of Massachusetts, but Wisconsin could have commenced its case as a plenary action in the District of Wisconsin. It's not required to intervene. It's not required to join it. Now, through the ordinary procedural...
Sure, but suppose Wisconsin or someone else files this False Claim Act or whatever it is, federal case, and there are a whole bunch of other plaintiffs who have claims arising from the same fraud or what have you, only their claims are under state law, so they can come in.
That's correct.
Doesn't mean they can bring a federal suit somewhere else.
Well, I'm not sure. Are you saying a plaintiff other than a state? I guess in this case, for instance, there are about 20 states have brought similar claims. This statute would allow each state to bring that independently in federal court. And what we're saying is if they elect...
These are states suing under federal law or under state law?
State law. Well, some have, but by and large, it's pretty much all state law. But the type of money...
Well, there must be some federal case here.
The federal connection is this. These are claims for funds under the Medicaid Act. All this arises under Medicaid and Medicare.
But there has to be a Section 3730 claim somewhere.
Yes, that is the claim brought by the federal government. That's the lawsuit that was unsealed in the District of Massachusetts.
And this statute allows others to clamber on board.
Yes, it does.
With their state claims arising from the same fraud.
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Does it do anything beyond that?
I'm saying that it does that in two ways. One way you can do that is you can go and intervene in federal court in the District of Massachusetts. Another thing this statute lets the plaintiff states do is commence their own plenary action in the federal district court.
But we wouldn't allow that under the supplemental jurisdiction statute.
Exactly. And that's why this statute...
But this is worded the same way.
Well, actually, the supplemental...
So is there some reason why we should interpret it differently?
Well, I think the supplemental jurisdiction statute's a little different in terms it talks about the same party to the case having the same claim. It anticipates A and B are in a lawsuit. It anticipates that there are two parties to a lawsuit, and one of those
allows
parties...
additional parties to be brought in.
Yes, it does, but it anticipates, though, that the person bringing the supplemental claim is going to be one of the existing parties to the lawsuit. This statute doesn't require that. This statute simply on its face says that district court shall have...
It doesn't say that, though, right?
It doesn't say it in the words as I've just explained it, but looking at the wording of the statute, it distinguishes between the pending action and the claims. And it talks about you can add these claims to a pending action. It does so by saying the district court shall have jurisdiction over the claims, but clearly it anticipates that the claims brought in the supplemental jurisdiction setting would be claims that a party to an existing case has. This statute allows a different party, a stranger to the pending federal action.
It doesn't say anything about strangers.
No, it doesn't say it. What I'm saying is 3732B allows a state which is a stranger to the federal action. It's not a party to the federal action.
About states.
It says the district court shall have jurisdiction over any action.
Right. And how is that different from the supplemental jurisdiction statute?
Because 3732B would allow any party...
That's your conclusion.
Right.
How is that different from what 1367 says?
1367 anticipates the claim will be brought by an existing...
Of course it does, but it's a matter of history, not as a matter of text.
Well...
So is there a history here which suggests Congress wants to have these... It is very strange to say that just because there's a fraud in one place that created a federal claim for somebody, a state or some other litigant that has a purely state claim can jump into federal court.
Well, it's...
Not in the same suit, which would make sense, that's supplemental jurisdiction, but somewhere else.
But keep in mind that the connection that the statute does require...
There's even a kind of constitutional question. What exactly, how is this within the judicial power of the state to have a litigant? There's no diversity. There's no federal claim. There's no admiralty. There's no diplomatic personnel. There's nothing, no Article III.
The Article III standing comes from the pending federal claim. These other claims that can be brought have to be related to the same facts and circumstances as the pending federal claim already in the courts. I agree. Without that, you would have a big Article III problem. But here, it's got to be interrelated and involved in that pending...
But look, it makes perfectly good sense to have related claims, state and federal, consolidated in one litigation. But here, there are multiple litigations. What's the judicial economy from permitting a federal court rather than a state court to entertain one of these actions?
The judicial economy is perfectly exemplified by this case. The central claim in this case is that the defendant manufacturer Day misstated price reporting and caused the state Medicaid beneficiaries, the payments for Medicaid to be inflated. That is the same claim in every single state, though.
So what?
Different.
Why should those other claims... I can see why you'd want to litigate all those claims in one court and one suit. But if you're going to have multiple lawsuits, what's the advantage of having state lawsuits with no diversity being litigated in other federal courts?
Because... The case has to be related to the pending false claims.
Yes, but what difference does it make that it's related? If it's the difference it ordinarily makes if two claims are related is that there's an economy from trying them together. These are going to be tried separately. Different courts, different bodies of law. Why should that separate second, third, nth suit be in a federal court rather than a state court?
Because in this case, the cases will be removed to federal court. They will be MDL'd to the multi-district panel for a unified hearing. The machinery is in place. The federal courts themselves will assess and perform the task of deciding.
If they're removable, they're removable. That's fine.
Correct. Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
You don't need this statute for removal.
Well, I need this statute because, as you pointed out...
Because they're not removable.
There's no diversity.
Right, precisely.
There's no diversity.
MDL is for consolidating suits that belong in federal court for some reason.
But look at the claim here. The Medicaid claim, you have a Medicaid dollar paid for a pharmaceutical.
Look, I know the claims are related, but they're going to be tried in separate courts.
As it stands, yes. And I guess what we're suggesting is that this statute should be read as a mechanism that would allow, in this case and other False Claims Act, where it's a unified...
Well, is there some history which...
No. The only history on 37...
Why was this statute passed?
32B that we have found is the states wanted to get this added, I think, to remove any suggestion that they might not be able to bring these claims because there's a bar in there. There really isn't that much to it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Merkel. Ms. Eberle?
May it please the court. Judge Crabb specifically did not rule on the question of substantive jurisdiction. She said that she doubted, but I need not make it a definitive ruling on that question. She said, assuming it's yes, I'm going to look at the question of timeliness. She awarded fees based on timeliness. That is all. She did not award fees based on the question of whether or not substantive jurisdiction existed. She specifically said, Day removed the case knowing full well that under the district court's interpretation of 1446B, neither the quitam complaint nor the order unsealing it could qualify as grounds for timely removal in this case. And then she went on to say, therefore, they had no reasonably objectable reason to remove it, and we're going to award fees because of that. I believe that it was not proper.
And the reason she said it was untimely, explain that to me, was that because this other paper, the unsealing of that complaint didn't qualify as one of these?
Exactly.
As the other paper or something like that?
Right. She specifically said it was untimely given the district court's earlier interpretation of the statute. So this is the third time this case has been removed.
Right.
The second time it was removed was based on a Supreme Court decision. Defendants claimed changed the law regarding substantive jurisdiction. They also had to justify the timeliness of it. So during this 2005 removal, the defendants claimed that it was timely under 1446B because the plain language of the statute allowed other papers from separate cases. And they also said it was timely because this Doe Green exception.
But isn't Day correct that if this statute grants jurisdiction, then there's no timeliness issue because their removal is the filing of an original lawsuit within the statutory period?
No, Your Honor, with all due respect, she said, I'm going to assume there is substantive jurisdiction. So she said specifically,
then
assuming...
Why is there anything except the statute of limitations to limit when they file?
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, they interpret this to mean, this statute, 3720B, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
3732B, they interpret it to mean that they can sue, or not they, but they can be sued in anywhere, right?
Right.
So, so if they can be sued, All right. When I've lost the thread, I see. Well,
I think I know what you're saying. In that.
Boy, you're way ahead of me.
And me, yeah.
The district court said that we're going to assume jurisdiction exists. Nonetheless, it's untimely. It's untimely because under her earlier interpretation of 1446B said, which extends the time for filing when an order or other paper is issued. She said it extends it 30 days after the issuance of that. She said, and she interpreted it as the majority of other courts that have interpreted it, that must be order or other paper emanating from the case itself. These documents from Massachusetts District Court are not papers, an order or other paper from our case itself. So she, like many other courts, interpreted it as restricted to excluding orders from other cases. So under her simple, plain interpretation of that statute, which she did in 2005, this paper from the Massachusetts District Court does not qualify, and therefore it doesn't extend the time for removal, and the removal was untimely. She laid that down in 2005. So it was remanded. And then a year later, they do the exact same thing. They claim a paper from a different court is timely under 1446B. She said, well, even if there's substantive jurisdiction, I told you last time in 2005 under 1446B, it had to be a paper from the case itself. And because of that, she awarded fees. There was also a discussion of this Doe Green exception to that law or to that limitation from the Third and Fifth Circuits. They said, well, under some, it was a very limited exception. In 2005, the district court interpreted that exception, and she laid down three very clear factors when that exception applied. She said it applied if it involved the same defendant, it concerned a similar factual situation, and it expressly authorized removal. In 2005, she said the Supreme Court opinion that you're trying to base timeliness on did not qualify it, and she distinguished it on all three of those points. 2006 comes along. Like I said, they removed the case again, and she said, you know, I told you the first time the statute's limited to cases, orders from the case, and now you're arguing again that it qualifies under this exception, this Doe Green exception, but I interpreted it the first time, and those three factors, that's the law of the case. And these Massachusetts documents, among other things, do not fulfill the factor that she laid down as expressly authorizing removal. So she said, I told you that, you removed it knowing full well that these Massachusetts documents would not qualify under my earlier interpretation. And for that, we're going to award fees. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's the issue and the only issue in the case. Defendants tried their substantive jurisdiction argument in six other district courts, and they all rejected them. And they tried the timeliness issue as well in six other district courts. The six courts either rejected it based on timeliness or substantive or both. Defendants put a lot of weight on the fact that Wisconsin is the only case that awarded fees. Well, that's simply because Wisconsin is the only case where they had a prior ruling setting forth this law, which is, you know, there is no controlling law in this circuit. So, and in fact, the South Carolina case, South Carolina v. Behringer Ingelheim Roxanne, specifically said that. They said, well, they're asking for fees, and we point to the Wisconsin case, but in the Wisconsin case, there was a previous ruling on timeliness under 1446B, whereas in the South Carolina case, there was not. Now, since that time, one other case has come down, and defendants rely on that in their reply brief. And they point to the fact that under the MDL, which is being presided over by Judge Saris, she did have a previous ruling on timeliness. And they said, well, in her latest rejection of their arguments, Judge Saris didn't rely on her previous argument or her previous order. But that's only because Judge Saris made a slightly different ruling. She emphasized something different so that Day's second removal under Judge Saris was not contrary to that ruling. So basically, the law of the case in the MDL from the previous ruling was different than the law of the case in the Wisconsin case.
I think we've got your point.
I'm sorry?
I think we have your point.
Okay.
Right. Okay, thank you, Ms. Everly. So, Mr. Merkel, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute if you want to respond to this timeliness issue.
On the timeliness issue, Your Honor, I would just like to point out the issue that's decided the second time around was completely different.
What does it have to do with the jurisdictional issue, though?
Under 1446B, you can remove a case that becomes removable when you're served with an order, motion, or other paper from which you first learned
to count. How does this relate to this jurisdictional question we were discussing?
And what happened was when the federal government unsealed the complaint and served it on us with the order allowing them to unseal it and serve us, that was the other paper that commenced.
What does that have to do with the jurisdictional statute?
Once that action was started, that jurisdictional statute became operative.
So what?
You're not
the plaintiff.
Pardon me?
You're not the plaintiff.
That's correct. See, before we're actually served with that summons, before there's an order allowing them to do that, I cannot use the jurisdictional statute I wanted to use because there is no prior pending federal case in federal court that would let me bring this in. It's not until the federal government sues me.
Saying you're the defendant, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we were talking about whether the federal government, having brought this suit, now other victims can sue in other districts rather than having to sue in state court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how does that bear on the timeliness of removal? So you're sued by Wisconsin under this statute, and you remove. Why is timeliness involved?
What happened here was the Wisconsin suit was originally filed several years ago in, say, 2002. The federal government didn't unseal this Ketam case against Day under the False Claims Act until 2006. So what we're saying is it's not until 2006 when we're actually sued, when we're served with the order allowing the suit, that we can avail ourselves of this statute and remove the case to federal court. Because up until that point, there's no prior pending federal action that would have allowed Wisconsin to even go to federal court. Once, though, the federal government commences the Ketam action, that's what activates that other jurisdictional statute that would have allowed Wisconsin to sue in federal court. And so that's how we get into the other paper.
Okay, I understand. You're right. Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.